I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Anne Marie Slaughter, CEO of the think tank New America, faced a personal and professional crisis a few years ago. It involved Google and a Google critic whom she fired from her organization. The press response was swift and critical, accusing Slaughter of kowtowing to a major funder. Slaughter also faced angry questions from her staff and worried that she would lose her job. She was in a very dark place. Well, she kept her job and learned some hard and important lessons. Anne Marie Slaughter writes in her new book, Renewal, about a mentor telling her to run toward the criticism, not away from it. And she writes about what she learned about herself when she asked others to be honest with her about her leadership style. She calls for a radical honesty in relationships and in politics as the country faces a series of domestic and foreign crises. Besides being CEO of New America, Anne Marie Slaughter is also professor emerita of politics and international affairs at Princeton University. From 2009 to 2011, she served as director of policy planning at the State Department. Anne Marie Slaughter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, I love it's great to be back with you.
Well, thank you very much. How dark was that dark place, and had you ever been there before?
Well, I've certainly had dark times in my life. I think we all have had. But this was a real crisis. As you know, I was 59. I had been leading a New America for 4 years, and was really kind of on the trajectory that doing meaningful good work that I wanted to be on, and suddenly I found all of that in jeopardy, and more importantly, it forced me to look back at earlier instances where my leadership had been called into question or criticized, and start to think about patterns, and frankly, as you said in your introduction, to run toward the criticism mm-hmm. rather than automatically defending myself against it. I had plenty of good defenses, we all do,
sure.
And some of that criticism was just wrong. I didn't do many of the things I was accused of doing, but that wasn't the point. And so, yeah, it was a very dark fall, and it did then trigger a process that at the time I couldn't have said, oh, I'm in a process of renewal. But looking back 3 years later, when I started working on this book, I could.
Well, you know, I was thinking about a crisis like that when it is so public. It's such a different, and when you feel like you cannot control the narrative, that's so different from, you know, an interpersonal private crisis that you might have with someone in your life.
Exactly. And As I write, my Twitter feed was just horrific. And
I
realized
imagine.
Very quickly that I just had to stay off all social media. I really only use Twitter. But yes, I mean, newspaper accounts and people you think you know who suddenly, you know, seem to have a view of you that you don't think is warranted. And, you know, many, many people have been through these kinds of public crises. And now when they do, I'm quick to write them because many, many people did also write to me. But again, you know, we have a choice about how we respond, even if we, you know, if I was fortunate enough to stay in my job and it's an organization I deeply love. But even then, rather than just putting it behind you, can you use it as a catalyst for change?
Well, you had this mentor, this David Bradley. He's the one that said to you, you know, run toward the criticism, even if you think it isn't warranted. And it seems like when it sort of almost goes against evolution, that when you see a threat in the world, the idea is to fight it or to run away. He was saying run towards it and almost embrace it because this person or this criticism is important to understand.
Yes. And that was really quite revelatory. And David is the chair of Atlantic Media. And as I write in the book, he's a superb mentor. But he said, and he put it, I didn't put this in the book, but he said, imagine you're having an argument with your spouse. And it is clear to you that your spouse is 98% wrong. and might be 2% right. Like maybe there's something in just a tiny bit of what your spouse is saying. And he says, run toward that. He said, that is, and of course, with your spouse, obviously, it's probably more likely 50-50, but you're not going to admit that. But his point was, that is the beginning of a learning journey. And, you know, a learning journey sounds trite, and we talk about a lot of this in self-help terms, but I took it seriously, and I then called all the other board members to say, okay, tell me what I'm doing wrong, right. And don't sugarcoat it. And I tried to do the same with many members of my staff, and I went back and talked to Shirley Tillman, who'd been president of Princeton when I was dean, and I looked at other instances, and it's not natural. But here's the thing. If you can do it, you feel stronger and more confident, right? You're not afraid that this thing will come again. And you're frankly much less afraid of criticism as a whole. And, you know, there's a lot about fearless feedback and asking for good feedback. This dials that up one and says, run toward the criticism.
And when you ask the board and people that you worked with to tell you about your leadership style, what it's like to work with you, what was the hardest thing to hear?
So, well, that's a good question. I mean, there was a lot of praise. I don't want to say, I mean, I kept my job, so I don't want to suggest it. So one of the things was something that I heard later also from Shirley Tillman, which was that I often put myself forward. I wrote things or said things that might conflict with what other people at New America said or wanted. That, in other words, I was not taking enough account of the people I worked with, and, you know, putting myself forward too much. This is a tricky criticism, particularly for a woman, because
well, I wanted to ask you about that. That's right, because women get criticized for not putting themselves forward. So finding that middle ground.
Exactly. And also being aware, like asking yourself, wait a minute, would you say the same thing if it was a man? But one of the people who gave me that feedback was someone who I deeply trust, another woman, a woman of color. And I really trusted it from her. And here's the thing. If you really ask, you hear such different things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she'd been my friend and on my board, and I'd had reviews, but nobody was going to say these things because they weren't terrible, but they were part of why, as I write in the book, I didn't have the kind of support from many people at New America, not everybody, but many people that I expected, and I needed to find out why. And so that was something that I really had a vision of leadership that was more, you know, me out front rather than me really kind of working with others and sometimes, yes, leading from behind.
Well, interesting that you say that. What I underlined in your book was, and I think this applies to all of us, about the gap between how we see ourselves in the world and how others see us, you know, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, I always feel like if you can understand your effect on other people, you can probably be a pretty good leader because you can see how people respond to you. But there is this gap about how we see ourselves and how others see us.
Yes. And that's really what I tried to learn to do myself and what I say that the country needs to do, which is to you know, look in the mirror and see what others see. I will say here, though, that this applies differently to different groups, because, of course, I work with women. I work with people of color who can look in the mirror and see something much more positive than other people see. But the work to be done is not necessarily their work. It's other people's work. So I say that I could do this as a white, affluent woman, right, and a woman who has power. In a way that I'm not sure I would advise it for one of my younger employees who might be, say, a woman of color. It's not that you should accept the world's view of you. That may be deeply biased. It is, though, that you should understand it And particularly if you are somebody who's discriminated against, you see it all the time. You see that they have a view of you. And again, I've seen this as a woman where I know men think I'm too emotional or I'm too this or I'm too that. And I think that's their problem, not my problem. but I also realized that there is an in-between there. And again, particularly for those of us who have the luxury of brushing off what other people say, that's not such a good idea.
You mentioned, and your book really does sort of toggle back and forth between some of the personal things we've been talking about, but our country, the kind of fraught politics of our country, and it seems, you know, we're at this interesting and difficult juncture of trying to figure out how to look honestly at ourselves as a country. And to use some of your suggestions about how to have that kind of radical honesty, how to run towards criticism rather than saying, you know, my country right or wrong.
Right. Exactly. And this is in many ways, I think, a description of the process that many of us are going through. And indeed, if you just look at some of the bestsellers, look at Clint Smith's How the Word is Passed, or look at Heather McGee's The Sum of Us, and many other books that I reference in Renewal. These are, in this case, African Americans descended from enslaved people who are telling another strand of our history. And actually, Jill Lepore, in her book These Truths, tries to do this very fully, to tell our whole history. And I grew up in the South with, on one side, Southern relatives going back a couple centuries in Virginia, North Carolina, and Kentucky. And I grew up in a household that would have described itself as certainly not racist. I don't think we'd qualify as anti-racist, but not racist in the personal sense, right, of being taught to discriminate, to see people as equals, but with a ton of structural racism, mm-hmm. as I now understand it. And as I write about even Monticello, Jefferson's home, you know, going to Monticello and hearing all the good stuff about Jefferson, and there is a lot of good stuff about Jefferson, never hearing, as Clint Smith would say, this was a plantation. This Thomas Jefferson's lifestyle existed because of the men and women and children he enslaved, including his own children, by a woman whom his son called his mother a concubine. But we have to assume that there, you know, sex was coerced, that it was a rape. So that kind of stuff is really hard to face, particularly when your own worth is tied up in this narrative. And yet my argument is, if we can face it and honestly embrace it, understand that it's not the whole story, but it is definitely part of the story, we will actually be stronger. And there's a vision there then of a nation big enough to hold us all.
That is Anne-Marie Slaughter, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her new book. It's called Renewal, From Crisis to Transformation in Our Lives, Work, and Politics. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Anne-Marie Slaughter. She is CEO of New America and a couple of years ago faced a very public crisis. She joins us on Radio Times to talk about her new book. It's called Renewal, about some of the hard and important lessons she learned. Also, what the country could learn from facing our own crises. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Emery, you used the word renewal, and I know you have a very specific reason for using that as the title of your book. What do you mean by renewal?
So to me, renewal is a word that captures a very important process of looking backward and forward at the same time. So it is not restoration, which is going backward, or restoring what was, but neither is it reinvention, which is creating something completely new, which I don't actually believe we can do. But it does look backwards. That's the re part of it. And that's the part about facing your past, facing your flaws with radical honesty. And it it looks forward. It has a new part. And it really does accept that if you can look back the right way and if you can learn, you can build something new and you can renew your commitment to your best self, to the country's highest ideals, to a new covenant. I actually talk about how renewal is so prevalent in many religious traditions because they have a covenant of some kind. And you fall, you know, you try to live up to what you've pledged and you can't and you fall short and we all do and we do as a country. But then you renew that commitment and you make a leap forward in a new way. So what I love about renewal is that it is this process. It's this concept and a process that contains both dimensions.
Well, and I wonder, just picking up on the more political side of what this book is about, where you think we stand today as a country. I mean, we're clearly divided. We are fighting over almost absolutely everything, including whether to wear a mask or not. We have covenants. We have documents that we say that we believe in, and yet we live in these parallel universes of how we see the country and how we see news and information. Where do you see the country today?
Well, I start by saying that I think we need a process of renewal that is much more than just reform, but short of revolution. And I actually mean that in that I think violence is not off the table. And whether it probably wouldn't be revolution, it would probably be closer to civil war. But I see an urgency for renewal, for major transformation. Yet we have to do it in a very particular way. And I don't think I have the answer to how we bring this country back together. I think we need a lot of work. And I would recommend, you know, Amanda Ripley's work on complexifying narratives, making things much less simple, or Adam Grant's work on how to think again. But I do think there is a way for all of us in this country to renew our commitment to what does make us American. And I do believe that, you know, Trump supporters, people who believe very different things than I do, they think that they are being American. They think that they are committed to American ideals, even if they interpret those very differently than I do. And I'm not sure, you know, there are certainly some people who, and if you recommend violence, that we have to deal with that in different ways. But I do think there's a way of saying, look, this is a great country. It is a country that has extraordinary potential. And it is big enough to hold us all. We are becoming a plurality nation. I don't use majority-minority because I don't see the value in everybody being called a minority, but a nation that reflects the whole world, just as we started out reflecting England, white colonists started it out reflecting in England, African-Americans who were enslaved reflecting Africa, and then gradually more and more Europeans, and over the second half of the 20th century, more and more of the whole world. And what I think renewal can be is a process not of harmony. We're never going to get to that. We're always going to be pluralist and we're always going to be divided and have disputes. But where we once again can recognize that we do have common bonds and that those common bonds are more important than our political identities, which have become sort of the total of us, when in fact, you know, we have many other identities, we have plural identities, and we are living in a plural nation that is to be embraced.
In fact, you say maybe it's time to rethink not e pluribus unum, out of many one.
Out of many one.
All of a sudden, yeah. My Latin went out the window. But you said pluris and unum, many and one.
Yes, and I say this in the context of 2026, which will be the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. I was 18 during the bicentennial. I was sitting in Charlottesville, Virginia, at the University of Virginia, you know, staffing a bicentennial booth. And you can imagine it was all red, white, and blue all the time. It was Jefferson. It was the Declaration of Independence. It was tall ships sailing into New York Harbor. A lot of triumphalism. And now it's going to be a very different celebration, yes, but commemoration, reckoning in many ways. Many people saying, look, my people were not part of that early nation. My people were not recognized as Americans. My people were enslaved. And yet I think we can take that moment to say, okay, yes, but we also have done a lot of great things over those 250 years. And we have enormous potential to be much more to ourselves and in the world. But we need this pluralist sense of who we are. So I say we can be many and one at the same time. It isn't, you know, out of many one, that's a melting pot idea, right?
Sure.
That we all become the same thing. No, we can be many and one, and we can learn how to be both and.
Where do you get your optimism? And I say that having read the newspaper this morning coming into work, and it was, to be honest with you, one more crushingly depressing story after another.
It was. And I do not, I read the news. And in fact, I was just reading a book manuscript on how civil wars start by a very good political scientist and looking at all the signs of the decline of our democracy. I mean, the United States has actually fallen on the sort of polity index to something that is a little short of a democracy. And I am deeply worried. I really do think there's the possibility of violence and civil war. But here's one reason I'm optimistic. If we had a political system that reflected the full spectrum of Americans' views, you would not have two parties. You'd have six parties. And the hardcore January 6th supporters would actually be about 20% of the population. It is because we have a two-party system and a first-past-the-post, you can win an election even if you don't have a majority, that we've got a Republican Party that is actually used to be quite split, but the only way they can win is to move further and further and further right. That does not reflect the American people as a whole. And so part of what I argue for is that we need massive political reform, which is coming. We've got it in Alaska. We have it in Maine. It's going to be on the ballot in lots of other states. Note, Alaska is a Republican state.
Yeah,
ways in which we can vote for the best person and ensure that the best person gets a majority of all votes, and that we could have more than two parties without being a spoiler.
Do we focus too much on Washington, D.C.? Because I'm thinking about the fights in Congress as we speak, having to do with, you know, trillions for a more caring economy, for infrastructure, fighting over the filibuster, over money in politics, where things are happening in the, you know, outside of D.C. But it often seems we have a rather D.C. focus when we, especially when we talk about our problems.
I do think we focus much too much on Washington. And, you know, people like Jim and Deborah Fallows, who wrote Our Towns a number of years ago, who crisscrossed the United States, have far better stories to tell. And indeed, New America's work has been increasingly locally connected over the last 5 years. And there are many stories of people coming together, particularly when you talk to mayors, for instance. They have to get things done. They can't just stall because their job is to execute. And there are many, many good stories. And there are stories of people coming together, even in what you would think of as the most divided parts of the country. So again, the incentives of the political system are both to appeal to the narrowest but most ardent base. I mean, think of your friends, right? The people who are just one issue all the time. Those aren't the majority, but the majority often is not willing, doesn't have the energy or the time to take them on. So there are many good things we can hold on to. The news, social media, all of that, again, drives us to the extremes. But there are ways we can constantly insist, look, it's a more complicated story than that. Look, that person is not just a Trump supporter or a Biden supporter. That person is also a mother. That person is a community volunteer. That person is a teacher. That person has multiple identities, and some of those we can connect.
And that is Anne-Marie Slaughter. She is CEO of New America, which is a think tank. She's also written a couple of books. The new one is called Renewal, From Crisis to Transformation in Our Lives, Work, and Politics. Anne-Marie, as we're talking, President Biden is speaking at the United Nations. Let me ask you first, and so we don't have, word for word what he is saying, but nonetheless, what is the speech that he should be giving? And then I'm just going to play a little clip from what he is actually talking about. But what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm quite confident that he's not giving the speech that I think he should be giving. But I would like him to give a speech that starts from the premise of renewal, that says, look, we have just ended the Afghan war. And we can now look back on the last 20 years and, frankly, the last 200. And in the last 20 years, in the Iraq War, in the Afghan War, in the intervention of Libya, which I strongly supported early on, and in other uses of American power, we have not only not achieved our aims, we have, in some cases, made things much worse through tremendous corruption and destabilization and the killing of many, many civilians. I mean, Americans, when they think about the toll of these wars, look to the toll of American soldiers, which of course we do. And these are members of our military whose loss is devastating. And that is what a nation does. But it's time to take our own creed seriously. The founders said all men are created equal. They meant all white men. But they, over time we've come to say they meant all. They didn't say all Americans, everyone on earth. And now we say all humans are created equal. Well, then it's time to measure the impact of our power by the impact on all human beings. And that's a very big shift. It says, let's stop focusing always on great power politics, the United States versus China, the United States versus Russia. Those, yes, Russia and China and Iran and other nations can threaten us, but our military is bigger than the next five militaries combined. We can develop and have deterrent strategies, defense strategies. We could spend far much more of our money and our talent on development, on actually improving the health and the well-being and the education and the living standards of people around the world, including people in the United States. And that would make this century not an American century or a Chinese century, but a global century. And we would frankly focus much more on climate change and pandemics than we would on China.
Well, let me play a clip from President Biden speaking this morning related to pandemics and related to vaccine distributions. It's about 20 seconds. Let me just play it and we'll talk about it.
Planes carrying vaccines from the United States have already landed in 100 countries, bringing people all over the world a little dose of hope. As one American nurse termed it to me, a dose of hope direct from the American people, and importantly, no strings attached.
So Anne-Marie Slaughter, I mean, picking up on what you were saying, I mean, is that a kind of way we should think about foreign policy then?
Look, I think that is a great thing. I am strongly supportive of the administration's desire to both transfer doses that we don't need and to increase the manufacturing capacity in many countries. Vaccinating the world is a no-brainer. It's the right thing to do, but it's also the smart and strategic thing to do, because until the world is vaccinated, variants will keep coming, and both the health of Americans and the health of the American economy will still be imperiled. So it is absolutely right. But are we willing to also say, you know, when China vaccinates people, that's actually good, right? Even if that's tied to Chinese power, vaccinating people is good. Now, the Chinese vaccines don't work as well as ours do, but they still work a whole lot better than having no vaccines. Are we really willing to think about vaccinating the world, not just in strategic terms, but in global humanitarian terms? Are we willing to use the UN's strategic development goals, which were formulated by all countries for the well-being of all people, and say, this is what America stands for? Mm. And yes, we're going to push back against China when China threatens us. But our, you know, where we are in the league tables against China, again, is less important than our impact on the well-being of human beings around the world. And frankly, many of the things China does, including building infrastructure in many countries see as positive. And many countries see that the way China has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty as positive. And the United States needs to focus on how we do that at home and how we collectively can do that abroad.
Well, let me pick up on that. But first, a very short break. Again, talking with Anne-Marie Slaughter. She is CEO of the think tank called New America. She's also a professor emerita at Princeton University in the Department of Politics and International Affairs. And from 2009 to 2011, she served as director of policy planning at the State Department. And she's got this new book we're also talking about. It's called Renewal, From Crisis to Transformation. Transformation in our lives, work, and politics. You can join our conversation after this very short break. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, let me just recap what we're talking about and who we are talking with. A professional crisis forced Anne-Marie Slaughter, our guest, to rethink her values, her work, her leadership, and her future. We're talking about her new book called Renewal, where she reflects on some of the lessons she learned from this difficult time, how they can be applied to the political challenges facing our deeply divided country. Emery, just picking up and right before the break, you were talking about China making investments in other countries, infrastructure being a very obvious one. But it does get me thinking about Afghanistan. After 20 years, we also invested trillions of dollars in that country. We did try to build some roads. They were often sort of unbuilt as soon as they were built. We backed a government that turned out to be extremely corrupt. We wanted to improve the lives of women, and one worries with the Taliban back in power whether those gains will be permanent or not. How do you see us using Afghanistan as a model that we can apply to the rest of the world? Is it a cautionary tale about what not to do?
It's definitely a cautionary tale. Although I will say that, for instance, in terms of women, a whole generation of girls were educated. We were there for 20 years. And many, many women, young women who were young when we came in, forged careers that they could not have otherwise as teachers and doctors and entrepreneurs and politicians. And we don't know the long-term impact of that, but for those Afghans, they did have a vision of a different kind of country. And I think we'll see what happens now, and we'll see what happens as many of them are in exile. But the long term, I wouldn't say that that was all in vain. I would say that we knew that we were destroying the very fabric of government with the amount of corruption. And what happens, and this happened in Iraq as well, the United States comes in with all of our dollars, and our non-governmental organizations come in with all of their dollars. And very quickly, the country is awash in money, and those who are corrupt use it. And we knew that Karzai's government was corrupt. We knew it 10 years ago when I was in government. And yet we decided, no, we were not going to make an issue of that, because maybe these were corrupt officials, but they were our corrupt officials, to paraphrase.
I hear you.
Lyndon Johnson talking about Vietnam. And that was the wrong call. Because fundamentally, again, if you are really thinking about the well-being of the maximum number of people, you had to see that the money we were pouring in was not getting to the people we wanted it to go to. And we simply could not face that. I mean, back to my radical honesty, when you read the Afghan papers, it's like reading the Pentagon papers. We knew in Vietnam that we were losing. We knew that we were not building the government we were building, but you couldn't face it. The generals couldn't, you know, people lower down couldn't tell people higher up. People higher up just couldn't face it. And so I do think it's a cautionary tale in a number of ways. One, if we can't nation build with the barrel of a gun, we are going to, there are situations I still think where forcible intervention is necessary, but it has to be multilateral, and there has to be a plan, and there has to be the ability of the country's government or proto-government to actually rule, which we did not have after the fall of the Taliban or the fall of Saddam Hussein. And more broadly, again, I think the lessons of both Afghanistan and Iraq are we are better off when we're working through development strategies than military strategies. Diplomacy and development often go hand in hand. I'm not suggesting we disarm, but again, we have more military force than any other nation in the world by a lot. I also think that, frankly, in many ways, our best example in the world is to live up to our values at home, which we are definitely not doing. And the last thing I'll say is our foreign policy elite needs to be far more diverse. We need far more people making foreign policy decisions who might look at some of this evidence more from the perspective of Afghan civilians than simply the army and the political elite.
So not so white, maybe not so male?
Totally. Not so white, not so male. And really, you know, it still is very white and very male. Biden has done his best. He's added a lot of women. Many of them are white women. But when you the higher up you go, you know, those voices are not there. And when they are there, they're very isolated. And if, you know, you and I both know, if you're one woman in a room full of men, you speak very differently than if you are, you know, a third women in a room full of men.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from James, who wrote pretty quickly as we began our interview. It's important to celebrate our pluralism, but don't we need to agree on an objective truth? There's several different truths being believed. And I mean, we're certainly living that particular drama, Anne-Marie Slaughter, about sort of living in you know, different spheres of what people believe to be true. And some of it is true and some of it isn't.
That is true, no pun intended, and a very important question. And again, I would refer you, Amanda Ripley has a wonderful book called High Conflict, where she has spent a great deal of time as a journalist looking at how you basically bridge alternate realities. And this is going to take a lot, and it's going to take a lot of education, and frankly, it's going to take a lot of changes in social media and the business model of some of the tech companies, but we can do it. I actually have been taking comfort in the language of the Declaration of Independence. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal and have an unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In our founding is the idea that there is a truth. And I think we need to return to that, to say, you know, nothing is ever 100% absolutely true. Science is based on the idea that, you know, we're constantly uncovering new things, and there are multiple perspectives. But, you know, there are things that are true, or let's put it a different way. There are things that are demonstrably false. And we have to be able to admit that we are wrong, that something we thought to be true is not true, because there is evidence, and the evidence of people we trust. And that is, again, part of the lesson of renewal, of embracing the idea that to be honest and to admit that you're wrong is a sign of strength and confidence and courage, and providing room for people to say, you know, maybe I was wrong. And that has to be for the left too, right? There's no question that some of the media on the left is also biased in the sense that it does not present a completely full picture of multiple perspectives. So I do believe in truth, or at least I certainly believe in falsity and lies. But I think it's up to all of us to complicate the narrative and to find places where we can admit that we're wrong. Because if we can't admit that we're wrong, nobody that we're trying to persuade is going to admit that they're wrong.
Here's a comment from Steve. This is to you. You mentioned that we are headed for a civil war. He says we are not. We never actually ended our civil war. As a girl that grew up in the South, from your perspective, is there some truth to what Steve says?
There is certainly truth in the idea that the structural and systemic oppression of African Americans in particular, and others of color, but African Americans in particular, continued under many other guises. And that white Americans in the South simply denied that it was about race. And yet, you know, you have Richard Nixon with his Southern strategy deliberately appealing to race. And you have Lyndon Johnson acknowledging that in signing the Civil Rights Act, the Democrats, he had lost the South for the Democrats. So, of course, it's about race. And yes, in that sense, the underlying issues of the Civil War are still with us. I will say, as somebody who studies international relations, war, you know, not having violence, open violence, is still a lot to be grateful for, including for the folks who are most oppressed, because believe me, they will be even more oppressed if we have violence. And so, you know, I wouldn't say we're still fighting a civil war. I would say that the issues of the Civil War are very much still with us, and that the United States will never be what it says it is, unless we face that honestly and repair it.
Well, isn't that where critical race theory comes in, which says that there are sort of institutional, structural parts of our country that are racist, which is different from individual racism?
Yes, I think that is unquestionably true. And I've spent a lot of time over the last 4 years on a journey understanding what that really means and how to look for it. And things like Ta-Nehisi Coates's article in The Atlantic on reparations, which was 3 or 4 years ago now. And I remember I started reading it thinking, no way. You know, we're not going to have reparations. And I finished it thinking we have to find a way to repair these injustices, whether it's on an individual basis or a more community basis. I don't know. But, you know, critical race theory, it's been demonized in so many ways. When I was first a law professor in the early aughts, it was just coming. It effectively says, again, we also have many different identities. We have intersectional identities. We can be white or black or male or female or transgender, or we can have different sexual orientations. And again, we have many identities that we can help create. And part of what we have to be able to do is to say, yes, this is true in terms of systemic racism, but that is not the whole story of the United States either. And actually, we need all of us finding a way to have a common vision to be able to repair it.
You say several times in the book, or you write several times in the book, sort of acknowledging your white privilege. I mean, you're the CEO of a think tank. You taught at Princeton University, and you worked in the State Department. That's a pretty stellar resume. How do you think of, especially white female privilege? Because I think sometimes we talk about white privilege, we ascribe it to men, but how do you see it for women?
That's a very good question. And I will say that one of the things I learned very quickly after writing an article in The Atlantic in 2012 about how women still can't have it all was I realized, my narrative was a white feminist narrative, not a black feminist narrative, and that much black feminism has actually been directed against white women as much as against all men for very good reason. And I do think the first step is to be conscious when you say we, and I say we because I have the privilege and power to say we, and to assume that if it doesn't speak for everyone, speaks for a lot of people, to understand, no, that is actually a function of a particular position in society, and to be very conscious of not only that you hold that position, but how you use that position, of how power relationships structure other people's interactions with you, which is often very hard to see. Fundamentally, for me, the answer has been to share power as a leader, and I write about that. So I am the CEO of New America, but I have a president who really runs New America with me. He is an African-American and Filipino man. He has a very different set of experiences than I do, but most important, by stepping aside and sharing power and putting yourself in positions where people can be honest, he can say things to me. He can allow me to see things, and other people at New America can speak much more openly in a way that is essential, because otherwise you don't ever realize the extent of your privilege or the way you're exercising your power.
Would you say
you can't change it.
And you can't change it. Would you say you're a better boss, a better leader, a better person as a result of these couple of tough years?
Oh, no question. And my life is much richer. And I value my colleagues much more. And I understand the pleasure of actually leading much more collectively, but also having a vision of an organization and a country where putting others first can often be deeply satisfying. And again, I say this knowing that for many women, that's something we've tried to avoid, because to take power ourselves, we had to act more like traditional men have acted. I think now I would say, if women, all women, not just white women, were really equal in power around the world, maybe putting others first would have as much value as succeeding yourself.
We're almost out of time here, but using yourself as an example, you do believe that as a country we can move in this direction?
I do. I don't. This is not we're just going to sail into a new dawn at all. We have a lot of work to do. But I will say that when I see the progress we have made, and it's just one example, but even watching the U.S. Open and looking at tennis, which used to be the whitest of white sports, and it's still pretty white, but, because of the Williams sisters and because of Arthur Ashe back in the 1970s, suddenly the Americans who are playing are much more reflective of our population, even if we have a long way to go. And when I see the talent in organizations, and I see the amazing talent in this country, white Americans as well as Americans of color, I look forward and I see a plurality nation, again, this week of the UN General Assembly, that will be a nation that truly reflects the world. And if we do it right, can play a critically important role in connecting the world and fighting truly global problems.
Well, I hope you're right. Anne-Marie Slaughter, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Marty, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much. And her book is called Renewal, From Crisis to Transformation in Our Lives, Work, and Politics. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Thank you for joining us.